From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour comes in a question that will be asked at a community forum tomorrow night. Would a metropolitan school district be good for Monroe County? That forum, 7 p.m. tomorrow night at Third Presbyterian Church, and it is part of the Crisis in Our Schools series that has already tackled some, well, controversial and you would call them hot-button issues. Common Core, teacher tenure, how do schools really stack up comparing the United States around the world? Why would anyone want to be a teacher? And more. It is a great and important set of discussions, and we're welcoming a panel that is helping lead the way with that. First of all, we welcome Joe Flaherty, who's the Executive Director of Writers in Books. Joe, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Dan Dermisich is the Chairman of the Coalition for Justice in Education. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Mark Hare is here with the Great Schools for All Coalition. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Well, let me start with you, Joe, because I was telling Joe and the group on this panel before we even got on the air today, you know, sometimes we think here at Connections we're on top of everything, but you guys have blown by us with these really remarkable forums, and I'm just now catching up to you. You have, since September, been tackling Common Core, teacher tenure, the real comparison of the United States students versus kids around the world, all of these important issues. And what was the genesis for this series?
Well, you know, at Writers in Books, we're always looking at using literature as a way to address issues for individuals, for our community. And so we've been doing If All of Rochester Read the Same Book, for instance, for 14 years, and this will be the 15th year coming up in 2015. But looking around and seeing, like, what has been one of the major issues in this community, and education kind of leaps to the top. You know, if you're following the news at all, there's you know, so much talk about charter schools versus public schools, the Common Core. So we had three people who were running for, more than that, for the governor of New York State, and two of them, a major part of their platform was that they were against the Common Core. And so you, looking around and saying, well, what can we do to address this issue? We selected a book to read, which was Diane Ravitch's The Reign of Error, as a way of for people to look at education, public education, what is the future for that in our community and around the world, and then getting together a really terrific planning committee of people who really deal with this on an ongoing basis and are so deeply involved with it, which is not something I am. I mean, I'm coming at this from how can we use literature, how can we use books as a way of getting people into discussing these problems. So we have people who are ex-principals, ex-teachers, or current teachers, current superintendents, ex-superintendents, et cetera, and looking at, okay, let's look at what are the ones that, as you said, are real hot-button issues, such as teacher tenure, Common Core, et cetera, and bring together people from all sides of it. So it's not addressing it as, okay, here's the answer to this. It's like, here's a question that's out there, and let's look at it and address it from many points of view. So we've had a discussion with Diane Ravitch, which we did by way of Skype, whose book you know, we're addressing here. The Common Core, is it good for public schools? Teacher tenure, good or bad for education? How do U.S. students stack up against the rest of the world? Why would anyone want to be a teacher? And now we're moving into two this week. Would a metropolitan school district be good for Monroe County? And then on Sunday at the library downtown, Central Library, what is the role of the community in providing early childhood education? So from my point of view coming at it, I'm here to learn as much as everybody else and to use these forums as a way of people in this community to look at, address, talk about these issues.
And Joe, how did you make sure that these were set up in a way to try to bring in voices that may not always agree? I mean, I don't know that you go to one of these events and you walk out going, ah, we've got tenure figured out, or, you know, but how did you make sure that you
represent? Well, I mean, with the planning committee and the contacts they have and networks, it's you know people who are on various sides of it. So we reached out to those people on both sides, or three sides, or four sides, and said, can you come to the table and part of the discussion? So for each one of them, there have been people who have, you know, disagreed with with each other, but made very salient points that people can think about. So we've made it. It's been one of our major efforts. Let's make sure we have people on all sides of this.
Dan, this is these issues: Common Core, teacher tenure, frankly, the performance of U.S. schools around the world. I've talked to many times to, for example, Howard Mafucci, a retired superintendent in East Rochester. He pulls what's left of his hair out over that issue, saying, you know, the metrics are skewed, and he's always getting fired up about it. Have these forums been, have they been emotional? Have there been a lot of sort of passion on these issues?
There has been a lot of passion, I think, from a variety of people that we've attracted to them. But at the same time, one of the things that we're trying to stress with these forums is the research. And that's often neglected within a great deal of the conversations that take place at everywhere from school board meetings to schools that are fortunate enough to have those discussions. But the research is kind of an interesting thing when it's presented to people and people get to think about it and digest it and ask themselves the question about why isn't this happening or why is it being so neglected within our school or our school district. In fact, that's going to be happening on December 3rd at the museum's Eisenhart Auditorium. We're going to be addressing another very interesting issue called What is a Good School? And in that one, we're trying to not only allow people to express their opinions about what a good school is, but also the issue of what does the research say in terms of what are the elements, the dimensions that effectively make up a good school.
Diane Ravitch's work, she has cited, I read her, I think her regular postings, her articles, her blog posts, and she is all about looking at data and research, et cetera. And I imagine Reign of Error as a core for this series champions understanding what the research says.
It does so much. And I know you're going to be getting to Mark shortly with the issue of metropolitan schools. But I think Diane points out something very interesting that a lot of people have trouble with. And that's when you deal with the issues of Common Core, testing, whatever, charter schools, that Diane says that often these can be considered purposeful distractions. And what she means by that is that when you look at what the real issues are, the central issues that are that we really ought to be dealing with, they boil down to two. One is concentrated poverty and the impact of concentrated poverty on the performance of kids in schools. And the second is racial and socioeconomic segregation. And why, after 60 years since the Brown versus Board of Education case, these things are worse as opposed to better.
We are more segregated.
Yeah, more segregated, more poverty. If you look at the paper today in terms of not only suspensions, but also infant mortality rate, it's incredible the amount of poverty that exists in Rochester and other urban districts around the country, but yet we're not effectively dealing with them. And the distraction, I think, that Ravitch points out is that why would a politician want to deal with these? Why would they want to tackle these when they're so divisive and probably potentially harmful to them being reelected again? And two, corporations, if you really want to solve the problems of poverty with a massive war on poverty and perhaps doubling the size of or lowering the size of class teacher ratios in schools, it's going to take a tremendous amount of money to do that. Corporations, I think, are fearing the possible hit on them through higher tax brackets.
Higher tax brackets. And that's, you often see the claim that, you know, we're already spending more per pupil, et cetera, et cetera. And it can be a hard sell and a big lift for politicians. But let me bring in Mark Herrer, who you were in. Did you go to Wake County with the group, Mark?
I did, yes.
You did. And for our listeners who might have heard the program a number of months back, there's the question on metropolitan school districts and integrated school districts. Wake County is one of the few that I know of anyway, Mark, and it goes back to the mid-70s. What they did, and that's Raleigh-Durham,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And they took urban district and one big suburban district and made it one county district. And if I'm remembering correctly, and Mark's about to correct me where I'm wrong, no school could have more than 40% free and reduced lunch?
That was the goal, yes.
Okay.
That's not the reality, but that's the goal.
Okay. And what did you see on that visit, first of all, to Wake County?
I was, like most of my fellow travelers, I think, Evan, very impressed with the kind of progress they'd made. You know, the theory from the prominent book on the subject by Gerald Grant at Syracuse, no bad schools in Wake County, which I think is about right. That does not mean that every school is a great school, but it means that there aren't any schools that you would be terrified to send your kids to. There are no schools where failure is almost a certainty. So in that sense, there are only good schools and better schools. So I was impressed with that. The second thing I was impressed with is the how on board the entire business community is in Wake County in terms of providing quality, high-quality public schools for everyone and access to those schools. The business community was pretty instrumental at the very beginning back in 1976. They kind of drove that decision to consolidate the school districts, in part because they could see that they could not begin to develop the research triangle that's now kind of fueled their economy if they had very bad high-poverty schools in the city. So they drove this, and they made it happen, and they're very proud of it. So I was impressed with both of those things. And the other thing that I found impressive is not just the outcomes in the schools, which are outcomes that I think we would die for here in the city, but the fact that the availability of good schools has made it possible to attract young families back to the city. You know, in Rochester, we have spent decades trying to figure out how do we improve neighborhoods, how do we make things better, how do we get business here, and we don't want to talk about the so-called elephant in the living room. We are getting close to that point where the only families who will live in the city are families who have no choice. You cannot get middle-class families to move into the city, buy a house, fix up a neighborhood, invest in it if there are no schools they trust. So all of those things in Raleigh were strikingly different from what you see here.
You've given us so much, so many different directions I can go in, and I wonder if, for example, I've talked to a parent named Megan Delhante in the city of Rochester who is one of the parents who wants middle-class families to want to live in the city and to say, if we don't embrace it, then the scenario that Mark is describing is going to dominate. And I absolutely admire her. I don't know that there are enough of her, and I think that she'll tell you that the goal is to create a movement. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't happen, I look at Wake County, and if they've been successful in almost 40 years, the question I have, Mark, first of all, hold on one second. Are you hearing that, Dave? I heard something in my ear. The one question I have, and I absolutely lost my headphones. I'm sorry. Yeah. Dave's going to try to figure. Can you guess? There we are. Sorry about that to our listeners. The one question I have is if schools are a zero-sum game, and by that I mean when we talk about it in Monroe County, there's 19 districts. Merging would be very difficult. We can get into that as well. But if you are in, I'm just going to start throwing darts here, Brighton, Pittsford, Penfield, mm-hmm. wherever, and you feel like you're in the better public school districts, and then you're going to merge and create one large countywide school district. Is it a zero-sum game in that some kids are going to end up with better schools and then the better schools are going to come down a bit? Because people who have worked with Wake County have told me they don't think it's a zero-sum game, that the best ones don't have to suffer. But I'm not sure that that could be true if no one is following Wake County's lead, Mark.
Well, there are some other school districts around the country that have tried similar things. There are some, and across the South, you'll find a number of consolidated school districts. So it's not that no one has done it.
Okay.
And there are other strategies that you can employ to achieve similar results. So I agree it's not a zero-sum game. And there is actually a fair amount of research on this that I think is hard for people to deal with and accept because it seems on the face of it counterintuitive. You can go all the way back to the Coleman Report in 1966 in the wake of the Civil Rights Act and find that the single most important factor that determines outcomes in education is the demographics of the classroom. People don't want to hear this. People want to believe still, even though we all know from our experience that it's really not true, that education means that the kids sit in a classroom and the teacher pours information into their heads, so it really shouldn't matter where you are or who you're next to. But that's just not what experience tells us. The research on this is pretty extensive, and has gone back for 50 years. And it is true that when you begin to integrate schools along socioeconomic lines, as long as you don't allow poverty to become the dominant factor in the school, So that's why they set that 40% figure that we talked about a minute ago. The more affluent students don't suffer. They do just as well as they've always done. And the poorer students do considerably better. So in Raleigh and Wake County, the graduation rate for low-income minority students hovers between 65 and 70%. They're not satisfied with that.
But that's remarkable compared to what we see here.
It's remarkable compared to what we have here. And the middle class, more affluent students, are still in the 85, 90, 90-plus, depending on the school graduation rates, that you would find in any of our good suburban school districts. So it's not true that this kind of commingling means that somebody loses. It's just a very hard sell. It's a hard sell for those reasons, but also because when we talk about it, people think they have just like this narration that runs in their head about school bus riots in Boston in 1972 or something like that, that, you know, that's the way it is. You're going to come and drag suburban children into horrible city schools and it's all going to be a mess. But none of that happens anymore. I mean, that you can't have mandatory busing across district lines. The Supreme Court struck that down 40 years ago. Everything that's done now, everywhere you go, is a voluntary plan. And so this idea that something's going to be forced on people is just not true.
Do you agree, though, that the parents in Pittsford who are concerned about their kids ending up in the city, there's going to have to be a long process of explanation and acceptance that it isn't a zero-sum game and that this isn't just you sacrifice so other kids will do better?
Well, I think that would be the argument that would be had if you wanted to push a metropolitan school district. Now, the group that I'm with, which is kind of still an ad hoc group, the Great Schools for All Coalition, is in the process of trying to reach out to a lot of people and develop some strategies for ways to integrate schools economically across the county. School consolidation is improbable here, not just because there's opposition to it, because in New York State, the Constitution prohibits the Big Five school districts from merging with any of their neighbors. It encourages consolidations of smaller school districts, of small cities, of suburban districts, but the Big Five cities have no such authority. So, yeah, you could change the law, but that's probably going to be a long, hard sell as well. So the question becomes, what can you do as an alternative to that? How can you achieve some of the same goals without doing that? And everything you do has to be voluntary. So one of the key things that people have done elsewhere is to create a series of very appealing magnet schools, elementary schools, high schools, that can draw people from around a county. So is that part of the answer here? Perhaps. But it will be scary to people until you begin to look at the reality of how you would actually do these things.
Very interesting, and you're seeing what they're going to be talking about tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. Would a metropolitan school district be good for Monroe County? 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Third Presbyterian Church as part of the Crisis in Our Schools series. And then this coming Sunday, what is the role of the community in providing early childhood learning? That's at 2 o'clock Sunday at the Kate Gleason Auditorium at the Central Library. So a lot to kind of digest here. And before we continue that discussion, let me grab a call. This is Don. Don's been waiting. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's already been discussed a little bit when you talk about Raleigh and Wake County merging what were essentially two school districts into one. My parents live in Tennessee, and in Tennessee, every county, and there's 95 counties, every county is a school district. So so you take a city like Nashville, the school district is the same between the city and the suburbs. It's all one school district. And Nashville is about the same size as Rochester, Metropolitan Nashville and Metropolitan Rochester. They have one school district. So students in a wealthy area of Nashville have the same potential of going to a school in the poorest neighborhood in Nashville. In Rochester, you have 19 school districts in the same, serving about the same population. That's redundant. That's wasteful. Why should I get so frustrated with it. New York State has the most segregated schools in the nation. Mm-hmm. Now I don't know what the what it is in Tennessee, but I would bet that it's probably more integrated in a state like Tennessee, where each county has one school district, and than in a a place like New York State, where each county has several school districts.
Thanks for the call, Don. Go ahead, Dan.
One response to that is that when you look in Monroe County in terms of the urban-suburban transfer program, I think out of the 19 suburban school districts, how many participate in urban-suburban, Mark?
Seven.
So you ask yourself, what's wrong with the other 12? What's going on? Especially when you look at the factors involved in urban-suburban, that A, the suburban district gets to pick the kids that they want to come to the suburbs, B, they can send them back whenever they want, and C, the money that was funded with the student in the city follows that student to the suburban school district. So why wouldn't you have people, you know, kind of saying, well, let's at least give some kids a chance to come out here?
Especially when you have that autonomy. I mean, that is a fascinating thing to me, that you have so many non-participants when they can't claim that they wouldn't have autonomy, mm-hmm. because apparently they would. But Mark, have you communicate with any of those districts who are not doing urban-suburban by choice?
I haven't talked to anybody in particular in the recently. I mean, I did it several times during the course of my years when I was a reporter. There's always some reluctance because they think it's not going to be well accepted. But it also depends very much on the availability of space. I don't believe you see any school districts that are creating spaces for city kids. If they have empty seats, they will take them. So, I mean, that's part of the issue. The other thing that has become a problem and will become much more of a problem is that when we talk about controlling for poverty in schools, that 40% figure is maybe not a magic figure, but it you'll find several schools in Raleigh-Wake County where it's 50% or even a little higher in some cases, but the number has to be held down. The problem now is that this would have been much easier to deal with here in Rochester 30 years ago. The city was less poor, as were the towns. So now you have a number of suburban towns where the number of free and reduced price lunch children has risen dramatically. In Gates Chilai, I think it's over 35%. In East Irondequoit, it's almost 50%. So these are serious issues. So a lot of these districts that are not high poverty districts but that are getting closer are probably not going to be in a position to do a whole lot of good by taking city kids in. So any solution that you come up with is going to have to look at that reality too. We are way behind the curve here. This should have been done in the 70s or 80s, and it's going to be much harder now.
When it comes to what you saw in Wake County, Mark, again, you go back to, I recall when Larry Marks was on the program, we were talking about this issue in the summer. I remember going back and trying to dig through some of the dissent or the concerns that were being raised in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Parents were concerned that because of that 40% number, and again, Mark is saying that they haven't held perfectly to it. The goal originally was you create a countywide school district, no school will have more than 40% free and reduced price lunch. And then parents were saying, well, does that mean that you're going to bus my kid 45 minutes just so all of the numbers work? And what happens if the numbers shift and the next year there's 42%? Does my kid go to a totally different school as a result? What's been the reality there?
Well, the reality is that they've had to kind of modulate that goal a little bit. As I say, there are some schools that are at 50% or even a little over 50%. And there's a couple of factors there in the case of Raleigh. One is that there's very high growth in the area. So when they consolidated schools in 1976, there were about 58,000 students in the Raleigh-Wake County School District. Today, there are 150,000, and they're looking at probably 200,000, 220,000 in the next 10 or 15 years. So there's phenomenal growth. They're adding 3,000 to 4,000 students a year, building 4, 5, 6 schools a year. It's a very hard thing to have an office of assignment, which is what they call it, which can balance that perfectly and calibrate it so that the school never exceeds 40%, partly because of the growth and partly because, as you rightly point out, I mean, families commit their children to a school, they're not okay with the idea that next year, because we need to get to 40%, we're going to move those kids again, and the year after that, move them somewhere else. So there are lots of competing factors here that have to be fed into it. What they do is they're very conscious of maintaining a manageable group of high-poverty students. But where that number of students begins to grow, they bring in all kinds of additional resources. So they know where there's going to be problems. They know where kids are going to be behind, and they account for that. They accommodate for it. And they create a number of schools that have an appeal to middle class and to wealthier students who will sit alongside poorer students. And but it's a delicate act. I mean, I think it's easy to think, well, if you just make this law, then everything will be fine.
Yeah, right.
It's an annual process of going through this, figuring out how to come as close as we can to these objectives. What additional resources do we need? How do we have to tweak it?
But here's an go ahead, Dan.
Well, I was just going to say that here's an example of the kind of incentive or the kind of opportunity that existed in Rochester, but nobody seized upon it. And if I'm not mistaken, just I think last year, Greece, I believe, closed one of its elementary schools. I think Kirk Road, if I'm not mistaken. There was an opportunity. You know, a number of families were upset within the neighborhood, you know, that their kid would have to go to a different elementary school or whatever. Maybe they were short in enrollment by 50% or whatever, but why not open those spaces up to city school students who could have collaborated together, formed a new school, even perhaps had a special magnet emphasis there that could have attracted kids not only from the city but from other areas of Greece as well. Nobody seized upon that, and it was an important opportunity, I think, not that that exists in every suburb, but it's an example of one kind of thing that could have happened.
Yeah, and I listen to what Mark says when he says, if Rochester had done this decades ago, we'd be in a different position. And here's where I wonder if we get paralyzed, especially in education. We get paralyzed, we let the perfect be the enemy of the good in a lot of things, but in education especially, because if you look at what Wake County did, there had to be some families who were upset for a little while. And the district had to be willing to say, "This is we're going to take some lumps for a little bit, and we're going to have to work out some kinks, and not everyone's going to be thrilled, and we're going to do our best." And so often, don't you think, Mark, we get in a position where we say, well, if 40% your barrier, it's going to be unfair to some people, shut it down. Or, you know, in tenure, it's the same question over and over. How do you get something that's perfect, and it seems to prevent something that's good?
We have become a community, I'm afraid, which is more likely to look for reasons why we cannot act than to look for ways to act. And you're absolutely right. This is a classic case of where it's easy to let the perfect become the enemy of the good. A 70% graduation rate is not good enough, but it's a whole lot better than what we have. And the reality is that we have the tools and the resources to make huge progress here if we're willing to try to do it. But we're very reluctant, very hesitant to do that kind of stuff. And I think if we don't act, we're going to have even worse problems. I mean, here's a simple example. This is what I mean. You know, we all hate to pay taxes. The city school budget this year is about $760 million. 10 years from now, will it be a billion? Somewhere along 10 years from now, 15 years from now, it'll be $1 billion. If we don't act, we will have a school district that serves essentially two purposes: to provide daycare to 30,000 students a day, to keep them off the streets for 5 or 6 hours a day, and second, to make sure that the poorest kids in our community do not come into contact with the more affluent kids. Because the educational outcomes are catastrophic. So that's a lot of money to spend for nothing that really resembles education. And that's where we're headed. If we don't act, we're going to let all of these kids fall through the cracks. We've already let thousands of them do that. We need to act, not just for humanitarian reasons, but for interests of self-preservation.
A couple points on that. One is that I think everyone needs to respond to the question of, are we going to pay now or are we going to pay later? If we don't deal with the issue now on a preventative basis in terms of dealing with the kind of outcomes that you're referring to, Mark, you know, just think in terms of the cost to society, in terms of welfare, in terms of prisons, in terms of remediation, in terms of child care and
That's everything else.
The other thing, too, that in terms of, I hate to use the word selling, but, you know, to sell this to the suburban communities, how do we do that? Two points here. One is the issue of the benefit for the kids who are there. They're going to be going into jobs, into communities where they may very well be dealing with multicultural dimensions. They have to learn how to work with people who are different than them. Second thing in terms of outcomes is that it's not only the academic gains that poor kids will make. They've shown in Raleigh, Wake County, that it has no significant difference in terms of the kids who tend to score better academically. But the other gain for both is the social capital that they learn, especially for poor kids who come into a situation where 60% of the kids are middle class or higher. They begin to learn things that are not part of the curriculum but are essential for survival, in terms of things like, I didn't know there was such a thing as a Kaplan SAT preparatory system, and I didn't know you could get funded for that. There were scholarships or whatever. I didn't know that the best way to go into an interview would be this way, you know, to dress differently or whatever. Kids begin to talk to one another, and that becomes perhaps the hidden curriculum might be even more important than the academic curriculum.
Well, I confess, with a 2.5-year-old son at home, I do feel a concern that he could go through an educational system and not grow up alongside very much diversity when it comes to race, when it comes to socioeconomics. And Paul, who's listening online, writes, can your guests elaborate on the point that was made about research and demographics? Mark?
There are a number of communities, and I think if you want to look some more up this yourself, Paul, you could go to the Century Foundation website and look for work done by Richard Collenberg, who's one of the leading researchers on this subject. There are a number of different models. They don't compare exactly, but there are efforts at integration in places as diverse as Hartford and, of course, Raleigh and Charlotte and all kinds of places across the South. What that research shows is that the concentration of poverty makes a dramatic difference in the outcomes of the schools, and that when you can begin to get middle-class kids into schools with poorer kids, the outcomes for the middle class stay about the same. The outcomes for the poorer kids improve dramatically. It's not perfect, and I think comes back to the question of the perfect being the enemy of the good. You cannot solve all the problems of poverty for poor children by putting them in a classroom with middle-class kids. And that's one of the questions that keeps coming up. You know, how does it make any difference if this poor little African-American child from Hudson Avenue was sitting in a school next to a more affluent child from Pittsburgh? Does that child get smarter as a result of it? Not as a result of doing that, but all the evidence seems to show that those kids will have a better chance at graduating from high school and going on to college than they would if they're in very poor schools. There is a fair amount of evidence on that. You can look at the Century Foundation to see it in a hurry. But it's not, I don't want to deceive people here. It's not a perfect system. That's not the only thing you need to do. But it is something that you can do fairly easily, fairly readily, that will have dramatic outcomes.
Yeah, Paul, I hope that answers your question. It's a great question. Joe Flaherty, when you wanted to create this series, I mean, this is exactly the kind of conversation I think that you were looking for, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I said in the beginning that I came in wanting to learn things myself. I'm certainly no expert in this area. But along the way, I think the thing that's been most impressive to me in terms of finding out things is the effects of poverty on education. When we had the forum on how do U.S. students stack up against their counterparts, well, you know, people see, well, you know, we're 43rd in the world or whatever. But then when you start to parse what's going on there, you find out that if you compare our poverty rate with other countries around the world, if you have our poverty rate's about 20%, we are, you know, far above any other country that has the same poverty rate. And if you take out the poverty rate, or you reduce it to the fact of, you know, most Scandinavian countries have maybe 3% poverty. So if you took only 3% of the people in the United States living in poverty and then had the students who are not in poverty, and compared to Sweden, et cetera, Finland, we're number one. I mean, people say the whole system is kind of going down, our public schools are horrible. If you reduce the effects of poverty, we're as good as any country in the world. So do we then, what's astounding to me, do we then concentrate on the effects of poverty as a way of solving the educational problems? It seems to be the last thing that is being done as a way of solving it. So you begin to talk about, well, we realize that there's poverty, what can we do to alter the effects of that? Do we take urban schools and say, okay, we're going to pour lots of money in there and have classrooms that are 12 kids and have more other kinds of social workers, et cetera? That's never discussed. What's discussed is that the urban schools are horrible, the teachers must be horrible. What do we do about it? So I would say number one for me, my learning experience is the effects of poverty on education.
It's interesting you say that, Joe. Just got an email from Michelle, and I'm trying to sort of edit on the fly. But Michelle says, great program, such an important subject. And she is essentially saying that she is tired of hearing people say, fix schools and then you'll fix poverty. We got the chicken and the egg problem backwards. Dan, you're nodding. What do you think?
Well, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, obviously, there's the chicken and the egg theory here of, do we fix education and that, therefore, that'll take care of the poverty, or do we fix poverty? I think it has to be a combination of both. I think all of us would probably agree that despite the statistics and the concepts that Joe just shared, is that even if we were to have an integrated school district within Monroe County, it doesn't mean that education is perfect. That curriculum can be changed, that teaching pedagogy can be changed, that the organizations can be changed in many ways too to make it a better system. So yeah, I think we have to work on both. But the primary issue is even by looking at the standards by which we measure kids internationally and also within the United States through NAEP testing, is that poverty is the issue. It's the number one issue that determines how kids are going to do. That's not to say, and I hear all the explanations by many of the city leaders, whether it be Lovely Warren or others, that, yeah, she made it and other people made it. But those are the exceptions. It's not the rule. So we have to look at the general population in terms of what's happening.
It's a great question, this whole question, which comes, but the chicken and egg question is just another way that we continue the paralysis. We can't answer which comes first, so we decide to do nothing. And fixing the schools is a way to begin to address poverty. As I said, it doesn't fix every family right now, but it gives kids an opportunity to do things they couldn't do otherwise. And why does it matter? Here's a simple example. In the worst effect of poverty, in my opinion, is that it leaves poor families completely isolated from the mainstream of society in a lot of ways that we don't even think about. 10 or 15 years ago, I got called by a principal or by a kindergarten teacher at School 22 who wanted me to come over and look at her kindergarten classroom. This is 3 weeks into the school year, and I went over there, and here's this classroom of 20 little children. She had the little tiny tables that you have at kindergarten, but no chairs, not a single chair. On the windows, there was not a single blind. There were no cubbies for the kids for their stuff. There were no crayons, no whiteboards, no chalk. There were no tools whatsoever except those that she was able to buy on her own to bring to the classroom. There were no books. And the most striking thing for her was that there were also no parents at the door demanding change. Why does it matter if these kids sit in a classroom next to middle-class kids? Because if 60% of those children were from Pittsburgh, the very first day, this problem would have been fixed. There would have been a firestorm at the superintendent's office. This would not be allowed to stand. In the city, kids come to school. They're already behind because they don't have the advantages that other kids have. They show up at school on the first day, and now they're a month behind before anything gets done because they don't have any materials in the classroom. And they start from there. That's why poverty matters, and that's why integration matters. And that's how the two interrelate, I think.
The other factor that I think we need to consider here, the other day I was just talking with Ralph Spezio, the principal at School 17, and Ralph has done a lot of work on lead poisoning and the impact that that has on students' cognitive development. I mean, basically, it turns to be an almost irreversible situation. And Ralph and many of his colleagues estimate that up to 10,000 of the students in Rochester are infected with lead. Now you take that in a classroom that affects cognitive development and behavior. Combine that in a 25 student classroom in an elementary school with the stress that some kids experience from drugs and violence in their neighborhood, poor prenatal care that impacts their ability to learn. Kids coming in with 500-word vocabularies at kindergarten versus that of 2,000 in suburban schools, the lack of role models, that positive role models, single parenting and the stress that puts on the family, and put that all into one classroom. And you have two or three kids that begin to act out and the impact that that has on other kids. You begin to say, this is not a good situation. And what we need to do is begin to do one of two things, either massive socioeconomic and racial desegregation that they've done in Wake County, or let's try something else that's going to cost money too, and let's cut the classrooms in half. Let's double the teaching force and reduce that classroom in half so that the teacher can spend more time with those kids academically and psychosocially.
If you want to join the program, I should have mentioned by now, you can call 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Our panel, Mark Hare from Great Schools for All Coalition, Joe Flaherty is the Executive Director of Writers and Books, Dan Dermasich is the Chairman of the Coalition for Justice and Education, and they are part of the Crisis in Our Schools series that is holding another community forum tomorrow night. Would a metropolitan school district be good for Monroe County? 7 p.m. tomorrow night at Third Presbyterian Church. And then the next forum after that is the following, this coming Sunday, I should say. It's the 23rd at 2 o'clock at the Kate Gleason Auditorium at the Central Library. What is the role of the community in providing early childhood learning? And then they wrap up on December 3rd at the Eisenhardt Auditorium at RMSC with What Makes a Good School? And the second I said the phone number, they started lighting up. So this is people are certainly responding. Before I get to the phones, Dan, real briefly, I know I've read Diane Ravitch here and there when it comes to Common Core, who's actually putting Common Core together, the Gates Foundation's role, et cetera. What was that discussion like?
Well, that was an interesting discussion and an interesting way that we carried it out. We actually put Common Core on trial. And we recruited two people to represent Common Core and two people to argue against it. And we did it as a moot court hearing with a panel of five or six judges. Van White was one of them. We had a couple other professors and city school district people, suburban people. What was interesting about it in terms of some of the dynamics was with this was that we found it difficult to recruit somebody to argue in favor of Common Core. We had to pull teeth out in order to get people to come in. Either it was because they didn't want to take a position or it's because they're opposed to it, but yet you have to follow the rules within New York State and certainly not give the impression to parents and students that we're doing something that's wrong. But off the record, there were a number of people who said, you know, I would have liked to appear on this, but I can't do it, you know, full-heartedly because I'm opposed to it. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, this is Pete in Rochester. Pete, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Look, I usually use the example of a business. A small business wanting to get started, you have to put together a detailed business plan. You put together the plan, you could have a flawless plan, but without adequate working capital to start that enterprise, the chances of your success are slim to none. The working capital, the startup capital, allows you the opportunity not only to set it up, but also work through the weaknesses in the plan. How do you do that with a family in poverty? You don't have enough money to start with to keep a secure, steady roof over your head, food on the table, clothes on your children's backs, let alone have the opportunity with time to research what you need to do and to invest the time in raising your children. It just defies logic and reason. And when I hear these business people wanting to get involved in education, look, you're in business, you do your job, conduct your business. You pay your taxes, pay your employees living wages so that they can go home and actually participate in the society.
Pete, thanks for the call. Let's hear what our panel has to say about that.
One response is that I think Pete is correct in many ways, and what we need in order to deal with poverty is a massive LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, style of a war on poverty, with more job training, more parental training, more Head Start, more of anything that we can do, more desegregation in housing, more housing assistance in order to combat the impact of poverty on kids.
Well, I think about what Mark Hare has said this hour that is going to stay with me, which is that we've lost all this time, that if there was going to be improvements, that more integration, et cetera, that there were more opportunities. It would have been easier 3 decades ago. And the more you go along, the more entrenched some of these lines are drawn, and the more difficult it is. What's it going to look like in 25 years from now, Mark, if there are not changes?
It's very hard to predict. I mean, I would say, just to, I think it was Pete's point, that we don't have the tools in this community to fix poverty. But again, that should not stop us from doing the things that we can do with schools. We can certainly take steps now that will not hurt anyone, that will dramatically increase the chances of success for the poorest kids in our midst. And we should do it without waste. We should do it quickly. We should do it in a variety of ways, and we should do it now. 25 years from now, it's very hard to say. I mean, you can look at the suburbs around Detroit and say people are still living pretty well, and they're happy with what they have. Will that be the case here in 25 years if we do nothing? Probably, perhaps. I don't know how much time we have. It's very hard to predict that. But what I would say is, the more pertinent question is, who are we? And what kind of community are we? What kind of community do we want to be? Are we okay with the idea that every year thousands of kids leave the city schools unprepared to survive on their own just because it's still possible to get a good education in Brighton or Pittsford or Greece or wherever? I don't think we are. And there are things we can do about it. So I don't know. I mean, who knows how long we have? But every year we wait, things get worse.
Keith and Victor. Thanks for calling, Keith.
Evan, interesting show, but I'm somewhat of a cynic, and I'm old enough to see all these ideas, plans come and go. But poverty isn't, in my opinion, and I'll believe my opinion until I'm proven factually wrong, but you have poor kids that just do abysmal in school, and then you have poor kids in the city that do quite well. And I'll bet you have poor kids in every school district in the city, in other cities that do quite well. I think what you should do before you try to reconfigure, work out, give raises, change things, is document how much parental or guardianship input there is in the child's day-to-day education. And the reason why I say this, I have some friends who are city school teachers. And they told me, as you can tell by the end of September, which kids are going to succeed and which kids aren't. It's not because of income or the color of their skin or where they live. It's by how much parental or guardianship input that they give to those children. You could have Stephen Hawking teach physics to kids, and if there's no backing by a parent, they're doomed to failure.
Keith,
there's never anything, any statistics drawn with that.
Thanks for the call, Keith. Let's let our panel respond.
Well, I think what Keith was talking about, again, are the heroic examples of kids succeeding within city school districts despite being surrounded by concentrated poverty. Yeah, there are kids who do succeed. There aren't many. I mean, what was it in terms of East High that they just decided recently that 5% of the kids in that school read at grade level? The other statistics in terms of looking at graduation rates, in terms of 40 to 50% of our kids graduating from city schools around the country, and then of those kids who go on to college, of those that do, only about 12% of them versus that of 54 or 55% of Caucasian students going on to college and graduating. There are significant differences, even for the kids who do graduate from city schools.
If you're heading out tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at Third Presbyterian Church, Mark Herr, just about 90 seconds left here, and again, you're part of the Great Schools for All Coalition that has traveled to see what metropolitan districts look like. Even though it's not likely to happen here exactly the way it has happened elsewhere, what's the goal tomorrow night? What kind of discussion, what are you looking for tomorrow night?
I think what we would like to pick people's brains on is how do we get a school system here in Monroe County that's more equitable, that gives more kids a better chance at a good outcome. And that's wide open. There are lots of things that we can do. But that's really the question. How do we make things dramatically different and do it quickly? And I think we're not helping ourselves when we talk just about, you know, the family structure of kids in the city. A lot of them come from difficult homes. A lot of them have broken homes. But we can't fix that. What we can do is create situations where all the evidence we have shows that they are far more likely to succeed. That's what we need to do.
And when it comes to suburban districts, and I don't say this to malign them, I think everybody's working on their own issue. I think there's a lot of heads down, not looking around. I think, you know, whether you're in Gateschild or Wheatland or Pittsford or wherever you are, there's a lot of putting your head down, working on your issues, and there isn't a whole lot of looking across lines right now, I don't think. Is there?
Well, one of the other obstacles that we deal with here is that there isn't a lot of looking across lines, is that even though this question of concentration of poverty is well-known, well-researched, well-documented, in New York State, there is not a single, and in Monroe County, there is not a single elected official who has any statutory responsibility for fixing this problem. Not a single superintendent of a single school district, not the county executive, not the mayor, no one. So it requires that people begin to get outside their job descriptions.
Mark Herr, Joe Flaherty, Dan Dermasich, all going to be there tomorrow. And Joe, this series has all of us wanting to talk even some more, and I think these are such valuable conversations. So tomorrow night, 7 p.m., Third Presbyterian Church, would a Metropolitan School District be good for Monroe County? Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Central Library, what's the role of the community in providing early childhood learning? And finally, December 3rd at the Rochester Museum and Science Center, what makes for a good school? We'll keep the conversation going. Congratulations on a great series.
Thank you. I mean, the idea is to get conversation going.
You have done that in, absolutely right. Dan, thank you. Mark, good to see you. Thank you. And thanks for our listeners joining the program today. I'm Evan Dawson. Dave Campo, great job as an engineer today. We'll see you on a Wednesday.